Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Good morning, Mr. McOtter.
Hello.
We're going to sea in Chinese submarines. 092, 094, 096. The suspects for launching that missile. And we're going to be joined by Captain James Fennell, U.S. Navy, retired intelligence officer. As you see from his notes, he's been tracking these submarines for his whole career. And the Chinese fired a long-range missile into a nuclear-free zone in the Pacific the day before NATO met. Perhaps a coincidence. So we'll take Jim for 20 minutes, two segments, get an education in tracking PRC, PLA, and boomers. Ask about the attack submarines as well. And then you and I will do two segments on the politics of the moment, about the crisis management of a candidate who blows up on you a week before the deadline for listing a candidate for the Senate seat. That would be Massachusetts. That would be Maine. But then we have a candidate in public office right now, a president who has guarded his embarrassments, revelations. That would be another method. There's no one way to get through it. I watched the Plattner blow up yesterday in real time, because the airwaves in the afternoon are filled with young, eager, a little naive, but very excited Democratic ops. Out of power ops. So a lot of fantasy, a lot of projection, a lot of teamwork, that kind of thing.
What were they saying?
That they knew something was wrong with Plattner, and they were wrong in trying to get through it, hoping it wouldn't blow up. Here's Jim.
And it sounds like the Democratic establishment blew him up, get him out of the way. I don't think it was Collins wouldn't have blown him up yet.
No,
the Dems pulled the plug.
No, it's like that hit in California right before the deadline for a candidate. What was his name, the Congress?
Was it Swalwell?
Swalwell. They blew him up right before as well. Here's Jim. Let me bring on Captain. Good morning, Mr. Fennell.
Good morning, sir.
I introduce you to my dear friend Thaddeus McOtter, former member of Congress, now writing for American Greatness. This is Thaddeus McOtter in Detroit, Michigan, right outside of Detroit, And Thaddeus, this is Jim Fennell, Captain Jim Fennell, U.S. Navy retired intelligence officer, somewhere in the Swiss Alps. Is that right today, Jim?
Yeah, I'm in Switzerland, eastern Switzerland, out on the Rheintal, the Rhine Valley, eastern Switzerland, near Liechtenstein.
No submarines near you can see. Is that correct?
No.
I note, for a man who spent his career at sea, you didn't go where the oceans climb.
I went where my wife was from.
I see. Well, what we want, what we desire and request is an education in Chinese boomers.
Okay.
092, 094, 091, 096, all these numbers. Do you call them zeros or O's? What do you call them?
Zero. I use zero.
092s and 094.
Right.
And then we can talk about the attacks submarines as well.
Right.
I'm getting a squeak. Do you hear that, Thaddeus? A little bit of a squeak. Okay. It's not there now. And this will be two segments, 19 and a half minutes for tonight, Jim. And
okay.
I'll begin by saying that the Chinese have been building submarines for 50 or 60 years. How are they doing? Attack submarines, inland, conventional, and then the big stuff, the boomers, nuclear-powered boomers. And then we'll get to, I'll start with that, the highlight of the missile that was fired. And why? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. And where are we? All right, it is 8 o'clock. I'm going to fire up the and read the New York Times on the long-range missile fired. Thank you. To you. Welcome to the making of the John Batchelor Show. Attending this morning, Thaddeus McCotter of American Greatness, former member of Congress from the great state of Michigan, and Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired intelligence officer in the beautiful country of Switzerland. And our attention is for the Pacific, especially a nuclear-free zone of the Pacific, where within these last hours, the PRC's PLA Navy made news. I read from the New York Times. With one missile fired over the Pacific Ocean from a submarine lurking off China's coast, the country's leader Xi Jinping has proclaimed his determination to build a full suite of nuclear weapons, including sea-based missiles that have long been Beijing's weak spot. The missile test on Monday came after China's military has been battered for years by mass removals of commanders accused of corruption and disloyalty. Gentlemen, good morning to you, a good day to you. We will begin immediately with a recording of this for the show tonight. I'm requesting from you, Captain Fennell, Jim, an education in Chinese boomers and then eventually the Chinese submarine fleet, which I've been educated to believe is playing catch-up on the U.S. Navy, has been for decades, has weaknesses in anti-submarine warfare, has weaknesses in silent boats. But this is a new century, and Xi Jinping is putting money into the PLA Navy, and they borrow the right plans. So we'll begin. Five, thank you. Four, three, two, one. I'm John Batchelor. China, the PLAN Navy. Building, building, building. Right now, the attention is on the submarine fleet because of events in these last hours. With one missile fired over the Pacific Ocean from a submarine lurking off China's coast, writes the New York Times, the country's leader, Xi Jinping, has proclaimed his determination to build a full suite of nuclear weapons, including sea-based missiles that have long been Beijing's weak spot. Captain Fennell, Jim, a very good day to you. Your note indicates you have been well-educated throughout your Navy career for the boomer fleet that China is building. What is the significance of this event? Is it coincidence that it comes a day before a critical NATO meeting in Turkey about the threat of Beijing, Moscow, Pyongyang, and we'll include Tehran against the Western Europe, especially against NATO. Good day to you, Jim.
Well, good day, John and Thaddeus. This launch is significant for the reasons that you mentioned in terms of being fired right before the NATO summit, but also as being talked about in the Western Pacific, it was signed within hours after Australia and Fiji signed a defense pact. It was also launched one day after the 4th of July, our 250th anniversary, and it was launched during the largest naval exercise in the world that's ongoing in Hawaiian waters called Rim of the Pacific or RIMPAC exercise. This was a submerged launch ballistic missile test launch from what we believe is a Jin-class ballistic missile submarine, or SSBN. It's a type 094, and there's six of those in the Chinese inventory. Four of them, at least, are the original class. There's some debate about which ones have been extended. There may be what they call two type 094 alphas, or improved classes, which upgraded from the JL-2 missile, which had a less than 8,000 kilometer range, to the JL-3 missile, which has a range of over 10,000 kilometers and has probably, according to Rick Fisher, our colleague, 12 independent reentry vehicles, maneuverable independent reentry vehicles, or MIRVs. So what was tested here on Monday is the second test of a PRC ballistic missile, nuclear ballistic missile, into the South Pacific in the last 2 years. There was a test launch in 2024 from a ground-based ICBM that went out into the South Pacific as well. And before that, the last previous launch, test launch of an ICBM or an SLBM by the People's Republic of China was in 1988 by their one and only Zhao class, or a Type 092 submarine that was test launched in 1988. So it had gone 36 years without testing ICBMs or SLBMs into the Pacific, and then they've done two launches in less than 2 years. So it's a pretty clear signal that they're ramping up their production or their program for sea-based deterrence, which joins their other two legs of their triad, their nuclear triad, which is the ground-based silos, which we learned in 2022, where 300 to 350 of these new silos were built in Western and Central China, and the unveiling here in the last couple of years of the H-20 strategic bomber for the PLA Air Force. So China right now is fully developing and preparing their nuclear triad to be on par with the United States and with China and to exceed us. And this test was a demonstration of that, and Chinese literature was very clear. This was about strategic deterrence, and we can talk about that next.
Thaddeus, you have a question for the captain.
Yes, Jim, you said this was on the heels of Australia and others entering a pact, the United States with NATO. Is this the Chinese sending a message to us and our allies that these alliances, as we continue to try to contain them, are becoming problematical to them and they're trying to push back?
I think the Chinese had this in development and that this launch was had already been scheduled. But like a lot of things that the CCP does, they use occasions like this signing of this defense pact, which was within hours of Prime Minister Albanese and the leader of Fiji signing this pact. Albanese, the Prime Minister of Australia, is in Fiji right now, or was in Fiji when this launch occurred. It was a way for China to do exactly what you said, which is to tell the region, hey, you don't try to gang up on us. Don't try to oppose us, because we have tools and capabilities, even up to this most extreme layer, which is the nuclear capability, and they're not afraid to show that.
The missile that was fired, Jim, can it reach the continent of the United States?
Well, John, it's a 10,000 kilometer plus missile, this JL-3, and those are estimates from the intelligence community. But what we know is that this missile, and there was just a graphic just before we came on put out by the Taiwan General Secretary of their National Security Council, Joseph Wu, just put out a chart that shows that the missile was likely launched from the South China Sea, from an area probably within 80 miles of Hong Kong, and it flew over essentially northern Luzon and by Palau, which is a U.S. Ally, and then through our U.S. territories of Guam, Northern Marianas, and the federal states of Micronesia before it landed somewhere probably within 100 miles or so southeast of Nauru in the deep South Pacific. And this missile, if you take this concept of bastions, which is what the Soviet Navy had during the Cold War, where you have these areas like the Sea of Okhotsk up in the, you know, in the Far East, or up in the north in the Barents, where Soviet ballistic missile and then Russian ballistic missile submarines operate today, the idea that you operate in this protected area where your fleet can protect your ballistic missile submarine, then you can launch from there and conduct a launch against the continental United States. So right now, a launch from the South China Sea or the Yellow Sea wouldn't necessarily be able to reach all of the continental United States, but it could reach the West Coast and certainly Hawaii and Alaska. And so the goal of the Chinese would be able to have these bastion areas, not just in the South China Sea, where they've kind of created one in this last decade by taking control, literally, of the South China Sea water space with their bases that they've built and their huge fleet presence, but they want to export that out into this first and second island chain area in the Philippine Sea to be able to create a bastion in that deep water where their ballistic missile submarines would be protected, but still be able to hold the United States at risk.
That is, you have a question.
So, Jim, with the triad, the sea-based triad is probably the weakest part, would you say? And how close are they to trying to get this on a par with us?
I think the sea-based part of their triad has been historically weaker, their air force as well, and you could say in many ways, because they didn't really have a strategic bomber. They had the H-6 bombers that, you know, there was some speculation that they had some nuclear capability. There's debate in the IC about that. But now with the H-20, that's on progress, that capability. The land-based is certainly very developed. And now the sea-based is developed over time. If you go back to the 80s, they had a single Gulf SSB, which was a diesel-driven ballistic missile submarine, and they did some launches from the Gulf. And then they did a few launches from the Zha, the last one, as I mentioned, in 1988. And from 88 until just recently, with the development of the Jin class here in the, you know, the turn of this new century, there was, you know, assessments that they were loud and noisy and could be easily tracked by U.S. Navy submarines or other anti-submarine warfare assets. Now, what we're seeing and expecting to come out in this next year is what is called the Type 096 follow-on ballistic missile submarine. And there's been hull formations of that up in the Bohai and Hulidau, which is the Navy base up there. The base at Hulidau in the Bohai is their one place where they build ballistic missile and nuclear submarines. And that base has been refurbished and expanded over the last 5 years. And now they're following on with new fast attack submarines of type 095 and the type 096 SSBN. And this is supposed to be orders of magnitude more quiet. It still won't probably approach the quietness of our ballistic missile submarines, but it'll make it much harder. And when you start talking about volume of platforms, when you add in China, you add in the Russian Far East ballistic missile submarine force, North Korea now is developing and has been developing one or two ballistic missiles, submarines, not nuclear powered, we don't think, but still this stretches essentially a static U.S. 7 fleet presence. The Commander Task Force 74, our submarine group, Pacific, Western Pacific, they have essentially the same flatline number of boats that they had when I was on active duty and even going back, you know, a decade or so before, the last 30 years. So we're being stretched to be able to hold what they use this term, hold at risk. The idea during the Cold War is that we were able to, and some will say that we couldn't do it, but we were planning to and had desires to be able to hold Soviet ballistic missiles submarines at risk, meaning that we would have a fast attack nuclear submarine in trail of a Soviet ballistic missile submarine. And just like Tom Clancy's Hunt for Red October, if we thought that they were going to launch ICBMs at the United States, SLBMs, we would shoot a torpedo at it before they were able to launch. Because it's only if you're in the Sea of Okhotsk or you're in the Barents and you launch a ballistic missile at the United States, you got about 32 minutes before that missile would land in Washington, D.C. And so it's a similar kind of race for time. But this, what's different today is back then we had 600 ships in our Navy. When we could play around and experiment and try to hold at risk Soviet ballistic missile submarines. Today we have less than 300 ships, and we still have a number of platforms that we want to be able to track. And that puts a great strain on our fleet to be able to hold PLA Navy ballistic missile submarines at risk, even if they're a little bit louder than ours.
Jim, I want to make sure I heard you correctly. The flight path could have been over northern Luzon, over Guam, over the northern Marianas, over the Marshalls. Did I hear you correctly? That could be the flight path.
Yeah, I'm looking at the chart that Joseph Wu put up, and I will send this to you. It just literally came in right before I went on. So it goes from essentially off Hong Kong through the northern Luzon in the Bashi Channel, bracketing, going between Palau and Guam, south of Micronesia, southwest of Micronesia, southwest of the Marshalls, and then landing southeast of Nauru.
Jim, that's
about 3,000 kilometers from Australia, by the way.
They don't have to hit the continent of the United States. That's our first line of defense. They flew over Guam.
Correct. It's a clear signal.
That's the U.S. Navy at Guam, right?
Yeah, the U.S. Navy's, we have a submarines in Guam as well. So it's a very clear signal. And the other thing is, just one comment about what was in the Chinese press all day yesterday as they were commenting on this. They made it repeatedly clear that this was a test to realize their goal of strategic deterrence. And you don't use submarines. And we have to couch that with China has always, the People's Republic of China has always stated that they have a no first use policy. That is their formal position. We have a no first use policy. Well, you don't test SLBMs and then come out and say that you're doing that to demonstrate strategic deterrence, nuclear deterrence,
right?
Except that you've changed your policy and it's really, in effect, a first strike policy. Now, they won't say that and they continue to deny it. But what they just demonstrated is clearly a first strike capability.
Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired intelligence officer. Thaddeus McCutter, American greatness. When we come back, nuclear weapons in the Pacific. I'm John Batchelor with my colleagues Jim Fennell and Thaddeus McCutter, and we're examining a mystery, which is why China chose to fire an extremely hostile missile capable of carrying nuclear warheads into the first and second line of defense of the Hawaiian Islands and the U.S. possessions in the Pacific the day before a NATO meeting in Ankara, Turkey, that is to discuss arming and paying for Ukraine's pushback against Moscow, understanding that Moscow regards this as an attack by NATO, and Moscow is in alliance with China. All these things can be real or they can be make-believe, but when we come to nuclear weapons, you don't want to be wrong. Jim, I want you to restate the Chinese position on nuclear weapons. I believe that they boast of being a signatory of no first strike. Is that correct?
That's right, John. China, the People's Republic of China, has historically stated that they are a non-first-use nation, and that's the policy that the Chinese Communist Party follows. Non-first-use. We will not use nukes first. Additionally, they've also said we will never use nuclear weapons against a non-nuclear state. So both of those statements were challenged on Monday. First of all, you don't fire a submerged launch ballistic missile, which is designed to be stealthy to allow you to have a first or a second strike capability. And then the rhetoric that came out of the PRC press, whether it was Xinhua or Global Times, the official press from the Chinese Communist Party was, we are going to realize a strategic deterrence. And you only deter the United States by having a first strike capability. So that's clear and unambiguous in my mind. And then secondly, if you're not going to strike non-nuclear states, then why do you shoot it into an area where there's a lot of non-nuclear, there's all it's a nuclear-free zone that is in that area. New Zealand and other nations have made that a nuclear-free zone. So they didn't obviously test a nuclear weapon, but still the intent of what they're doing is about strategic nuclear usage.
Thaddeus, you have a question.
So, Jim, this would then be in addition to the economic pressure they're putting on countries in the region, countries that may align themselves with the United States here, now adding this perhaps as another threat, another coercive arrow in their arsenal to get other nations on board to prevent their own encirclement and containment by the West?
Very clearly, Thaddeus, this is another layer of their efforts to be able to achieve their goal, which is to drive the United States out of the Western Pacific and maybe more areas, but immediately to drive America out of the Western Pacific. And they will use all levers of national power. And they've used conventional force structure this last two decades. As we mentioned earlier, they've built islands in the South China Sea. They're surrounding the Senkakus. They're surrounding Taiwan. They're sending carrier strike groups into the second island chain and operating even east of the second island chain last year. They're using economic power and economic coercion against nations that oppose them, intimidation like we've seen against the Philippines or Australia in certain specific areas where they're in disagreement. They use diplomatic pressure to get nations to turn away from Taiwan and recognition of Taiwan, to recognize the PRC, and to also promote Chinese propaganda into the Central and South Pacific region. And that's probably this last piece here is adding in the nuclear dimension. It's kind of from the PRC's perspective, it secures this total package or what they call comprehensive national power, CNP, this comprehensive approach that they take to a national objective. It goes across all spectrums of governance.
Captain, we have a minute. What do you recommend Indo-PACOM do to respond to this provocation? We have a minute.
Well, one of the things we have to do as a nation is decide where we're going to put the majority of our resources. And we need to start plussing up our naval force structure in the Western Pacific. That's the first thing I would do. In terms of a statement, I would highlight and comment on the exercise that's going on in Hawaii with the Rim of the Pacific that shows that despite their demonstration, we're still unified with a lot of allies that they don't have. And then I think third, it's even possible that we have our own nuclear capabilities, and flights with B-2s out into the region, just a flight through, would send a signal that, hey, we saw what you did and we have a big stick as well. As President Trump said to Kim Jong-un a couple of years ago, you know, my button's bigger than your button. And some people would see that as very escalatory, but I think it's something that has to be demonstrated to the PRC, that we're not going to back down.
Not taking tea in the Forbidden City, you mean? Is that where you're going here?
Right.
The U.S. Navy has a response. We wait. It's been 24 hours. Captain James Fennell is the beginning of the response. That is McCutter, American Greatness. I'm John Batchelor. Wonderful recommendation, Jim. Wonderful. I until you mapped it out, I had not thought, good heavens, Jim, this is a blow against everything that's been done in the Pacific for the last 5 years. And aimed right at the Solomons in Fiji all the way.
Yeah, it flies right over everything that they've been, you know, moving in economically with their naval, Coast Guard, fishing fleets. It just puts a cap on it. It reminds everybody that, you know, you got to deal with us and play our game or you're under this umbrella.
And a two-ocean war.
Right, with Russia helping them on the Atlantic side.
Well, there's the business.
And I forgot to mention, they're in the middle of this joint sea exercise, China and Russia, right now off of Qingdao.
Where?
Off of the Shandong Peninsula in the Yellow Sea. Oh. China and Russia just started an exercise on Monday, right when they launched that missile.
So the missile boat was part of the exercise.
Well, it's interesting because if you read the announcements from the Chinese about they list the two Russian boats, Vinogradov and the other one, I can't remember right now. They list those two boats, a destroyer and a frigate. They list the two or three ships that are from the Chinese surface fleet. And then they say, and an unidentified submarine. So could the unidentified submarine be part of the exercise, even though it's down in the South China Sea?
Could be. They're being cute.
It could be.
Is that like them, to be cute like this?
It seems a little bit much for them. That's something I'd expect from Putin or Korean, North Koreans. But still, the idea that there was an unidentified submarine that they left an ambiguous name to it, and then this launch occurs on the day that the exercise starts off Qingdao, that's another – hit my head over that. I forgot to include that. That's important.
We'll come back to it. I'm fascinated by your interpretation of the China Daily quote, tasked with realizing sea-based nuclear deterrence and counterstrike. Translate that, Jim.
Well, the second half of that where it says counterstrike is clearly second strike. But realizing sea-based nuclear deterrence, you only achieve that deterrent effect by being able to launch first when they can't find you. That's the deterrent effect. That's the way we view it. We view deterrence with our boomers as, you don't know where they're at, so don't mess around with us because we can launch first.
The theory of the triad is there are defensive deterrents, not an offensive deterrence. Are they acknowledging that they've developed an offense with their submarines?
I don't think they will not admit this. They'll still hold to they're still in a no first use stance. And they'll use that phrase, you know, retaliatory strike. I know I'm pushing it and stretching it, but I guarantee you that's the way they are thinking. They want to have the capability to tell us, if you muck around with us too much, we can still strike you first if we want to, and because you can't find us.
That is, you have a question for Jim.
Yeah, is this also not a case of them trying to put the seeds of doubt in the non-nuclear countries that align with the United States that, yes, you never know, we do maybe put in the crosshairs?
And that they can challenge America, and America's unreliable.
Yep.
Now, Jim, the fleet's at Guam, correct? It's been there since 1943. It's not
correct.
Leaving. You fire a SLBM over the adversary's fleet, and you expect nothing to happen?
Well, it didn't. If you look, I sent you the email. If you look at the track, it didn't. Now, this is a track from Joseph Wu from Taiwan, so, you know, you got to couch it with...
It's compatible with the track that the New York Times publishes.
Similar, but it didn't fly directly over. I mean, it probably flew close to. So, but the point is the same. They flew it into our U.S. territories.
The exclusive economic zones, yeah. That's what they flew it through without any hesitation whatsoever. They knew what they were doing.
Oh, no, there's no question, because if they had launched from the Bohai, that trajectory would have been much different.
Did you see anything on this yesterday? I mean, I see the New York Times piece, but they don't translate this.
There was no track information. There was nothing all day Monday and up until just right before I went on. I saw that Joseph Wu from Taiwan had finally released it. The PRC has released nothing. In terms of the missile type or the boat,
anything from the Philippines, anything from Marshall?
No, the Japanese. Oh, and that's the other thing I forgot to mention. The Chinese notified "quote unquote" relevant nations before they fired it. So they notified Australia and they notified Japan. We know that, and they told them they were going to fire a ballistic missile. And the Japanese came out and said, hey, we don't want you to do this. So the Japanese press was all over this. Hey, we told them not to do this. Australia, because Albanese was in Fiji, Penny Wong, who's their foreign minister, who's as red as they come, she said, you know, this is disturbing, but it was a pretty moderate statement compared to the New Zealand defense minister, Winston Peters, who was pretty hey, this is very dangerous, shouldn't be done. You're going into a nuclear free zone. Penny Wong said, yeah, you know, this is disturbing. And then she goes, I won't speak to their intent. I won't speak to the PRC's intent. So this shows you the Australian current government's position. They're appeasers.
Supine.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the 094, the boat, either an improved 094 or the original. Is that something we can sink?
Yeah.
Can we sink it in the Bastion Sea without coming out of the first island chain? Can we reach that far in?
Our fast attack boats can get in there. It's, you know, it's not like sailing in the Philippine Sea. It's not as, I mean, it's, you got to go through a channel, got to go through the Bashi Channel or come in through up through Malacca or one of the other, go through the Philippine archipelago to get into the South China Sea. But we could get in there, and I can't go into detail, but we operate there. Submarines operate there. And they're loud enough that, in fact, you know, I'll just say, when I was on active duty, China was sending submarines for the first time out into the Indian Ocean. And I was an advocate for holding at risk every Chinese submarine that left to go out into the Indian Ocean. And I'll just say there were senior officers to me out at 7th Fleet and Pac Fleet that said, no, we don't have to do that. They're loud. We can find them when we need to. And I was like, there's nothing like doing it for real. Make us do it. Make us get back to the way we were when I joined the Navy in 1986, when we were the real badass Navy of the world. And if we wanted to track a submarine, we could track a submarine. And I can just tell you, when the Chinese Song-class submarine popped up behind the USS Kittyhawk on October 26th, 2006, it was a cluster.
Yeah. Do they know, use it or lose it? Do they know they're dead men if they shoot?
They may not believe it now because we're smaller Navy size and we don't actively practice it. But they may believe that. That's why they're going to build a lot of them.
The other fallback is missile defense. Are we deployed in Palau, in the Marshalls, in Northern Marianas, in Guam?
Do
we
have most of our missile defense assets of the 7th Fleet are up around the peninsula in Japan.
I see. Not in Luzon, not in Guam?
Well, when we're down there, yes, but we're not there all the time. We're stretched thin, man. We're stretched thin.
What about land-based missile defense?
We have, that's what we've been putting in some of the Ryukus and some of the stuff that gets the Chinese all upset. But, you know, there's some limitations to those. I mean, because these ICBMs are not like a short-range ballistic missile where you're trying to shoot down a shorter-range, lower-altitude ballistic missile compared to an ICBM that's really, you know, taken a much higher trajectory. So that I'm not sure how well some of those systems work.
Okay. Jim, we're fighting the wrong war over there in Ukraine.
It's
the decision that Churchill and Roosevelt had. Europe first or the Pacific? And Ernest King said, I'll take care of the Pacific. We need an Ernest King.
And we need, but Ernest King was, he got saved by the Two Ocean Navy Act. If there had been no Two Ocean Navy Act, I don't care how much of a son of a bitch Ernest King was, there's no way he used to brag about he was a son of a bitch. He couldn't have won that. Nimitz couldn't have won it because they wouldn't have gotten the fleet that we needed.
Yeah, you've made another point about the building. It's not, you do not trust their talk about building.
Right.
Great report, Jim. Thank you. And we'll talk up the detail about Japan and Australia. I'll send a note to Gordon and we'll do that. Maybe next Monday. Are you traveling next week?
No, I'm here.
Okay. Gordon and Lydia are in Europe, so I don't think we have time to get to them for tomorrow, but we'll try next week.
Okay.
Some of us civilians got to do this right, Jim. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Jim.
I appreciate it. Nice to meet you, Thaddeus.
Nice to meet you, Captain.
I read your stuff online on American Greatness, so good stuff.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I read yours.
Great report, Jim. Thank you. Well, Thaddeus, I wonder if the administration is paying attention to what we just learned. Somewhere. As you said, that's a flight over all the islands we've been in contest over with their soft power. The Solomons have fallen. Australia doesn't push back hard. But Palau, Northern Marianas, and the Marshalls. Northern Marianas, Saipan and Tinian are where they built their casinos. And where the Chinese nationals don't need visas to land in Saipan.
But I think what they're deathly afraid of, and they've always been afraid of that, one of the things they always talk about is they don't like to link issues. They're afraid of being encircled. They're afraid of a containment policy, much as we had the Soviet Union, eventually a rollback policy, but the first step is containment. And they're sending shots across the bow of any country in their immediate, to use Putin's phrase, the near abroad, to scare them off so that they don't align with the United States and they can't be strangled. Yeah. And that's what they're afraid of. And we're trying to do it economically, even though you get fits and starts of it. But the supply chain and everything else, and as Gordon Chang will tell you, their demographic implosion is not that far away. So I think they're doing everything they can to ensure that they have some breathing space that we do not encircle them, I think. That means that we should encircle them even harder. They're telling us what they're afraid of.
Yeah. And we're not telling them that we're going to do anything about it.
No, and it's not because we're being sneaky. I think it's because we're just not doing it.
Well, it strikes me to remind myself that there are grown-ups in the Trump administration, but not a lot of them.
Yep.
And the way the Defense Department is now postured, I don't think it's about defending the Pacific from a Chinese attack.
Well, you hear that we're shifting resources, but that's not necessarily, that may be enough to trigger what the Chinese just did with firing the submarine-based missile, but sea-based missile. But I don't know that we're doing it as smartly, as quickly as we possibly can, based upon, you know, as you said, that there are some very smart individuals in there, but then there's also a lot of posturing and other things that just are not being helpful at this point.
All right, let's turn to the politics of the moment, because I want a lesson in crisis management for a campaign. The example I can offer is the Maine Senate seat, now held by Ms. Collins, as a ambition of the Democratic National Committee to win the Senate in 26 and to begin a dominant role in 27. So we'll start there. I'll also mention that Mitch McConnell is said to be very ill in hospital, and there is the possibility of that seat turning over, but I don't think that's a crisis for the Democrats. It might be for the Republicans. The Senate is 100 princes. It's not the same as in the House. But the Senate race in Maine will start there. However, we have a new day of revelations that come right before a deadline, and we'll go to California and what happened there in the gubernatorial race, and begin to puzzle how you manage crisis with candidates who are not entirely transparent when you take them on as a candidate. Here we go. This is lessons learned in big-time politics, choosing candidates. 5, 4, 3. Thank you, Thaddeus. And then the second part I'd like to turn to, again, your prospects for the Republicans, which look mighty grim. Republicans in 26, what are the themes that they can sustain themselves with? The Democrats are clearly going with affordability. I see that all the time. What have the Republicans got? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. Politics in 2026. Midterm ahead. Both parties manage their recruiting, their fundraising, and their candidate choice in similar fashion. Now and again, however, you meet a crisis. And how do you manage that crisis? Yes, you can boast about how much money you've raised. You can boast about your wonderful issues that you've identified in polling. But what about the candidate? Two recent examples for the Democratic Party illustrate to me that there is a recovery from a crisis, but it's a tough road, and you need to be disciplined. Thaddeus McCotter, American Greatness, is a veteran politician from the great state of Michigan, a veteran politician who observes other politicians and other candidates and how they get in and out of difficulties. Thaddeus, a very good evening to you. I begin with California, most recently in the gubernatorial race to replace Mr. Newsom, who is termed out. The choice clearly early on and for quite some time, right up to a huge fundraiser that was about to happen the next night, was a young congressman named Sewell, I believe. Swalwell. And he was young. He had a young family. He was very active. He had been associated with scandal, something about, oh no, it was too romantic. It was a Chinese spy, something like that. But it had not in any way deterred the Democrats from seeing him as a young face to put into Sacramento. Very wise choice. He had been active during the House intelligence meetings, backing up then Representative Schiff, now Senator Schiff. So clearly he was part of the apparatus that saw itself as traditional, but young and eager and ready to take on the Republicans point for point and face up, battle it out. The Democrats often complain that their candidates don't hit back hard enough. Well, Swalwell was a hitter. And then revelations that you can't say were transparent. A number of incidents that suggested that Swalwell had abused women or had deceived the party in questions they'd raised about his conduct as a married man and before he was married as well. Now, that's a crisis. And the Democrats managed it, and I watched it from a distance and didn't report on it. It just seemed natural affairs that followed, and Swalwell was not trustworthy. A very effective politician, but he'd had that incident with the Chinese spy that I couldn't say was true or false. It was a strange story. And they handled it right up until it blew up in some fashion that I didn't think about at the time, but now I do. It was right before the deadline to choose a candidate, for the number one candidate for the party. And they did choose, and it was the man who'd been trailing badly in the polls. I don't think he'd been in the top four or five contenders. It was a large field. His name is Becerra, I believe. He had been the
Xavier Becerra, he's a former member of Congress.
And
he was the state attorney general.
Attorney general in California, and then he was in the Biden cabinet. And they chose a man who had no popularity, no face, no money, and all of a sudden he was the candidate, which he now is, because they overwhelmingly nominated him, and we can presume he'll be the next governor. Now, did I miss something in the way that happened, or was that artful on the Democratic side? They knew Swalwell was a problem. When it became overwhelmingly unmanageable, they blew him up. Does that make sense?
Well, it would make sense that the other candidates would be more than happy to blow him up. I think the Democratic establishment would be more than happy to see a potential liability blown up. But remember, California is a deep blue state. It's going to be very difficult for the Republicans to win that, regardless of who's the candidate. So it's really an internal Democratic problem. And even more so, it's an individual candidate's problem running in the primary. So there were a lot of people circling each other. And for Swalwell, they found the ability to get him out of the race. It was put out, and he's out. And Becerra was always going to be, I was surprised he wasn't running better even prior to the Swalwell revelations. But I think this was really the other candidates trying to clear a path. One of them leaked it. The Democratic establishment was more than happy to pocket it and just look the other way and let it happen?
It reminded me years ago, and I didn't put these things together because they seem so different. The Iowa primary, Joe Biden did very poorly, and then came New Hampshire. And the night of the New Hampshire results, Mr. Biden had done so poorly, he left before the press conferences, flew on to South Carolina. He just left town. So he wasn't even there to talk about how his candidacy needed to be reinvigorated. And at that moment, the clear winner, if the party followed the lines we'd seen at Iowa and New Hampshire, was going to be Bernie Sanders. Now, this isn't anything to do with scandal. It has to do with the party leadership making a decision that Sanders was not their candidate. And they went for Biden. And the South Carolina was so overwhelmingly an endorsement of Mr. Biden, he just sailed through the rest of the candidacy. Is it possible that the Democrats knew that Biden was going to do poorly in New Hampshire and had him had everything prepared?
Oh, I think if you're talking about the Biden campaign, they clearly did not want Bernie Sanders to be the nominee. They wanted someone who had the appearance of a centrist, so they adopted Biden. They wound up going with the Sanders agenda, Bernie, the DSA's agenda with a human smiling face, I suppose. What you're seeing now in certain areas, we're seeing this in Maine. I don't think it was the Collins campaign that blew up the presumptive nominee because they would have preferred to run against Blattner. I think it was the Democratic establishment that wound up getting rid of him, or at least trying to get rid of him. I don't think he's out yet. We're seeing this with the candidate that dropped out here in the Michigan Senate race. You had two relatively mainstream women, Representative Haley Stevens, State Senator McMorrow. McMorrow has dropped out, and they're very afraid of the Democrat Bernie Sanders support doctor out of Dearborn. So what they're doing now is I think they're trying their best, the establishment, to clear out as many of the DSA as they possibly can.
This is in the Democrats are doing this. Is that in Michigan?
Yes, right. Because the Republicans would love nothing more than to run against Democratic socialists, especially in purple or light blue or light blue, purple or light red states. The DSA is considered radical. It's extreme. It's only shown any success in deep blue urban areas. And so when you look at swing states for the Senate or you look at swing districts, the Republicans would prefer to run against a radical socialist Democrat whose agenda is still far from mainstream anyway. Other than deep blue cities.
So the Democratic Party has decided to blow up the DSA candidates, or that's already happened?
It's happening. Look, we had talked about this before. You had two civil wars in each party. You have Republicans, establishment versus MAGA. MAGA's ascendant right now. Yeah, on the Democratic side, you have the Democratic establishment and the DSA. And if you listen to the DSA or you listen to the Justice Democrats or however they're trying to call themselves, the Democratic Socialists in America, the reality is that's a civil war. And neither side is going to show any quarter to the other one. And I think we're seeing that in places like Maine. We're starting to see it in places like Michigan. Although McMorrow dropped out, but she was a relatively, these days, a left, but not a far left candidate. She dropped out. I'm sure there must have been something behind that. Because Haley Stevens would definitely be the preferred candidate of Michigan Democrats heading into a general election. But we'll see. The DSA, the Sanders wing, the extreme far left of the Democratic Party is in the ascendant. And that civil war is really just in its initial stages right now.
Well, let's use the main example. What I know so far, it's real time, is that a man named Plotner, I believe, a political newbie, not well recognized by the party ops, from their own remarks online. Everybody's online these days. You can watch them. They're very agile and talk a great deal. Not radio talk, sort of club talk. And I learn a lot about the younger. These are
salon talk. Yes.
Yeah. They're millennials. They're not even Gen X. They're under.
I'm just Gen X.
Yeah, you're Gen X. They're under 40s, and they have a lot of energy. And Plotner had troubles early on. And what I heard yesterday was we should have prepared for this. I wonder if they did, because July 13th is the deadline for putting a candidate on the ticket. And heretofore, Plotner had excited the party because of DSA issues that he was stating clearly about fighting the Republicans and other remarks. And the other candidate in the race was a former governor, a senior female figure, much revered, who had voluntarily stepped aside, or seemed to step away. She was regarded as the consistent with the establishment. And yet now that Plotner has blown up, or appears to be, I don't want to get in front of this.
Yeah.
There's, as of 24 hours ago, it didn't look good. Let's put it that way. they did it before the deadline, just like happened in California. And I'm wondering if there's a pattern here, or I'm, as Gore Vidal told me, never say conspiracy when you can say coincidence.
Well, there's no coincidence here. They blew him up. They get him out of the way. He was slow. He was not doing that well in the polls. His grassroots fundraising wasn't all that great. His major donor fundraising wasn't all that great. I don't think his latest report has come out even yet. So, look, if you had a well-liked former female Democratic governor, especially in running against a popular female Republican senator, I think that she would have been the much better choice than Plotner. I think that what they were looking at in Maine was they were trying to find their John Fetterman. And they found him, except he didn't have the intelligence or the integrity of John Fetterman. So what they did is they latched onto something. They thought, oh, this will fool the MAGA people. He looks like MAGA, but he's not. Well, he's clearly not MAGA. He's clearly something or other. So I think that the Maine Democrats, I believe the Maine Democrats did everything they could to move this guy out, because Collins would not want this guy out of the way, because he'd be the most easy Democrat to beat for her. So again, I think the Democratic establishment is very wily. These are the people who ran Russiagate against an incumbent Republican president. They're devious, sneaky, and quite effective, unfortunately.
Well, both teams have some.
You could ask Bernie Sanders about that. They right. stuck it to him a couple times as well.
No, when you sit back far enough, both teams have a lot of skills.
They're devious, cunning, evil
yes,
little people,
and they can masquerade it by with moralisms. But basically, they got the mechanics down.
This is why I'm a recovering politician, Mr. Batchelor. Recovering politician.
The Republican Party deserves your attention a little bit today, because I would say that they have a bit of a problem coming up, a midterm with an unpopular president. And clearly there are skills that can be called upon, vote locally. So when we come back, Thaddeus McCotter, American greatness, recovering politician from the great state of Michigan. And we will turn to the Republican Party, what is not and what is the label MAGA. I'm John Batchelor with my good friend and colleague of many years, Thaddeus McCotter. American greatness is where he writes. Former politician, recovering politician, Thaddeus prefers, and I do too when I remember it. We've spoken of the Democratic Party having skills to recover from a candidate who is troubled and not candid about the troubles. Now we turn to the Republican Party, looking at the midterms, X number of weeks to go, troubled and with skills, however, to recover. This is about the House of Representatives. I'm not going to speak to the Senate right now. The House has enough stories to tell. The president is, according to the polling, not popular, not anywhere close to where he was at the election in 24, nor in the first year of his candidacy. That is not necessarily important, because the president's not on the ticket. So what is the Republican Party to do when faced with the enthusiasm of its own base that is MAGA, all for the president, and doesn't show a lot of ability, or maybe it does. I ask Thaddeus, do you see MAGA converting its talent for boosting Mr. Trump into converting into enthusiasm for the various candidates that are at risk for the House?
Well, I think that what happened, if you look back at the history of the Reform Party, the history of the Tea Party, I think you can see that Donald Trump had identified those types of grassroots movements within the Republican Party that may not actually have been Republican, that they were much more populist. His candidacy brought them into the Republican Party. They became branded under the Trump banner with the Make America Great.
Right.
And so moniker. And so when you look at it, then you have the Republican Party has this element within it that is not necessarily Republican. It makes it easier for the president to, when things do not go to his liking, to talk about how the rhinos and the GOP establishment are the problems, they're the enemies. And so what you've taken then is these populist movements, and under the Trump rubric, they have now relatively been not alienated from the Republican Party, but they consider themselves separate and distinct from the Republican Party. And yet there is not a real programmatic platform. There are some general outlines of things that they do or do not like, but it is basically gone from a movement of individuals to a movement behind a man. And so the question will be, how long does that movement survive if the president is no longer there to lead it? Obviously, he will try to name the successor. He will then also continue to play with his endorsements in midterm elections, and I think even up till the end and after of his current term, his final term. So I think that it's basically now it's devolved into a man. And unless there is some fleshing out of the underlying principles of it beyond just the general sketches that we currently see, it very well may not last very long. And I think the Republican Party establishment is tired of being just kicked around as if they've done nothing until the arrival of Donald Trump down the escalator. And so that civil war is still simmering, and it will explode again. I don't know if it'll be 28, but if there is a wipeout in 26, it's certainly not going to avail to MAGA to stanch the revanchist Republican establishment.
Individual members of Congress calling on MAGA, is that wise or stand clear of MAGA at this point?
There are some, John, that are MAGA.
30 seconds, that is.
There are some that are MAGA because they got Donald Trump's endorsement. They ran as MAGA and they're in office. They probably beat others. But there are many that did not, will quietly go through the motions, and they'll try to do what they did at the Tea Party, which is co-opt it and crush it.
Thaddeus McCotter, American Greatness, recovering politician.
Recovering.
Commenting on both major parties and their skills when things go awry before the deadline.
I have a passing acquaintance with
that. On the deadline. The word dead always tells you this isn't a good thing. I'm John Batchelor. Oh, that was fun, that is. Let me write
it's down. Fun not being there.
It's a coincidence that they do it right before the deadline. It's a coincidence.
Yes, yes. People who do nothing but think, live, and breathe politics. Yes, it's just a coincidence.
And some of them are paid for it. They're pros. They're good.
Handsomely paid for.
And they know what they're doing. And everything is, you know, the calls, the polling, the gathering of the community, the right language, raising from a large base, everything was there. Plotner made a statement yesterday that was textbook, could be studied to, when really deeply in trouble, this is what you do. But it's always so much trouble, even the good speech isn't going to help you.
But they had a great candidate to run against Senator Collins. And she stepped aside for this because this was a heat of the moment type thing. As you've always said, John, the Democrats want to fall in love with their candidate.
Yeah. And
sometimes that's not a good thing.
And there was age involved, too. One candidate was 80. The other one was in his 40s, I believe, or a young man.
Yeah, he's 40s, yeah.
Yeah. And age is never a good indicator of where you should go. But it can be used as a crutch. I understand that. I'm watching to see how they get out of this one. They've got till the 13th of July to come up with a candidate.
Yeah, wow, what weird, isn't it? Just right before the deadline, they met. Wow.
We're not suspicious people.
No.
I do not.
Oswald acted alone, too. Yeah.
I do not see a confirmation from Germany, so I believe there is no confirmation today. On the 29th, that was last Tuesday. And I sent another request this morning, and no, it's unusual, but no confirmation. So we will meet again.
All right, so we're done for today?
We're done for the day. I will thank the audience. Thank you very much for us first worrying about a nuclear weapons attack from China and then worrying about blowing up candidates right before a deadline. Here come the Roman Orchestra. Yeah. Thank you, Thaddeus.
Again, very familiar with that, yes.
And take it away, boys and girls.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
In the next Rare Well Done, the Thrive team helps two people with CIDP tackle the tricky issue of friendship. They say the quiet part out loud.
In the event my CIDP worsens, my friends might decide it's too much.
Get nudged outside their comfort zone.
I don't know if I want to.
To forge stronger connections.
It's the best thing that's ever happened to me, our friendship.
To Rory.
Watch Rory and Michelle take on the friendship factor on the next episode of Rare Well Done.